Thank you very much for coming this afternoon. My name is Mark Rowland and I work for the human rights group Jubilee Campaign. And that's not to be confused. I was speaking to Tony Campolo earlier, sorry to name drop, but I said I work for Jubilee Campaign and he said, oh yeah man, I know that one, you're very active on third world debt. I said, sorry Tony, it's not actually that organisation. We're a separate human rights group, we are part of that coalition. And last year, Diana and I came as part of the campaign to free a guy called James Maudsley, who was in jail in Burma, and also to raise the profile of the human rights abuses that are continuing to happen in that country. Let me just start in prayer. Dear Jesus, we thank you for the country of Burma, for the people of Burma, for their struggle, for their experience, for their hope, and for their courage. And Lord, we pray that today as we learn and as we speak about the activities of the last year, the victories that have been accomplished, that you would inspire us to continue, to persevere, to do what we can for justice and freedom in that country. Amen. Just want to start by describing a short story that I recently heard at the celebration of the anniversary of the 13th anniversary of the 1988 student uprising in Burma. This was after years of a military dictatorship controlling the country. The students, the monks, and that general population rose up in Rangoon in a peaceful demonstration. And the guy that was telling me this story, he was saying that he was there in Rangoon. He was there fighting the cause. He was there promoting human rights and justice. And he saw a girl called Kwa Tor, who was a 14-year-old girl who was like a sister to him. She was passionate about the cause of democracy. She knew her consciousness had been galvanized by the suffering of her own people. And she ran through the crowds, pushing her way past, holding the red national Burmese flag. And she ran up to confront the soldiers that were facing her. And she ran up onto the tank. And she saw this girl. And he couldn't stop her. And the crowd was shouting out, "People soldiers! People soldiers! We are the people soldiers! Don't shoot! Don't shoot!" And the order came from on high, from the military officers, to start shooting on that crowd. And she was on the tank, and hers was the first body that got riddled with bullets as she flew from the tank. And he watched her body fly from that tank, and she lay on the floor. And as the firing continued, he was torn, because he saw her lying there, and yet he had to run for safety. And all he had time to do was just throw the flag that she was still holding over her dead body as he ran. And more people were killed in 1988 in that student uprising in Burma than were killed in Tiananmen Square the year after. But guess what? There were no video cameras to capture those events. So we don't care, and we don't know. And nobody did anything. And the people are still suffering. And the military are still in control. A year and a half ago, to my shame, I knew nothing of Burma. I didn't even know where it was or what the situation. It was just an enigma to me. But I heard of a young man, a Christian, white, middle-class guy like myself, who had taken it upon himself to go to that country and make a peaceful protest against the atrocities that he'd seen and experienced. And he was put in jail given a 17-year sentence. And I got involved in running a campaign with Diana. Diana is James's mother, as many of you will know, and many of you will have been here last year when James was still in jail. And we want to go back and revisit what happened and give you an update about the situation and the campaign that many of you will have been involved with. I want to introduce Diana Maudsley to you. Please give her a warm welcome.
Oh, thank you, everybody. And thank you for being here, because all morning my stomach's been going round thinking, oh, what if nobody comes? But I do thank you most sincerely for coming. I brought a letter that James, all the letters that he received and that I have received while James was in prison, was almost overwhelming. I answered many of them by hand, but it got too much towards the end. So James wrote, when he got out of prison, he wrote a letter that we could send to everybody who had written to us. And I brought it along just to quote little bits of it. But just before I start, for those who don't know a great deal about Burma, the situation is twofold. There is the democracy movement run by Dor Aung San Suu Kyi, who is head of the NLD, the National League for Democracy. She won the election with 82% of the vote, with an 85% turnout, something our politicians would weep for. But she's not permitted to rule. The other issue is the genocide taking place on the borders, the ethnic minorities, the Karen, the Kareni, the Shan and the Mon. And their lands hold great wealth. The junta are out to exterminate them and take that wealth, the oil, the gems, and most cruelly sad of all, the heroin crop. The money from heroin keeps that junta in power, along with the petrodollars that Premier Oil, the French Total, and American Unocal have driven through the homelands and the heartlands of the ethnic minorities. So the problem is twofold. And our country has a debt to the Karen, who in the war were our staunchest allies. And I think it was Sir William Slim who said the Second World War, the Burma that campaign in that part of the world, would have gone on far longer without the help of our loyal Karen. So I'll start off with a bit of James's letter. I was happy to get to prison, happy to be there, and very happy to get out. Throughout that time, I wanted to use the opportunity of being close to the junta so that I could challenge their injustice directly. As I was close to other prisoners, I could demonstrate solidarity with them, also very directly. I am so glad, though, that there were many people and groups on the outside working for my release, alongside working for the broader issues in Burma. I could not have maintained my spirits without their support. I know it must be incredibly difficult to write to a stranger, and to a stranger in prison, and again with the prison being in a totalitarian country where all mail is censored. But I did receive wonderful letters. It is enough for people to say that I and the situation in Burma were in their thoughts. That brings great comfort when there is a regime trying to isolate you, tell you you are foolish and a terrorist. Some people wrote with world news or jokes or poems, all of which is great to read. And some older people would write about their families, their grandchildren, the nature about them, and gardening. James told me he sat in his cell with one old lady's letter, thinking, he thought himself into her garden. And I just think, that lady, I thank you with all my heart. Perhaps surprisingly, I also got letters from people who were expressing their very frank disgust with the regime. They would write of their outrage at the abuses of human rights taking place, and would make it very clear that the outside world was becoming increasingly interested and angry about the terrible injustices. These letters gave a wonderful boost to my spirit. And then there were the letters which included Bible references. These references were acutely appropriate. Many of them made me not only encouraged and strengthened, but positively joyful. Amongst them, Romans 8, 35 to 39, Psalm 33, Romans 12, verses 9 to 21, and Wisdom chapter 6. I also give praise to God that through this experience has introduced me to so many good people who are working hard for justice in whatever way they can, many doing it silently. I can have no doubt that good is a stronger force in the world than anything else, and it will prevail. I'm currently writing a book about what I have seen in Burma. I do not see our involvement in promoting justice abroad as charity work, or even merely our duty. It is more than these. It is in our own interest. In fact, it is absolutely essential to our society and to the environment and to our souls that we look to our brother's freedom. As Martin Luther King Jr. said, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. So all the letters, I have never written to a stranger before this, and I found myself replying to these people. The support was overwhelming. Our postie used to get letters, James Maudsley's mum, Burma. I live in an out-of-the-way village in the northeast. I've kept those envelopes. I think they're absolutely enchanting. I don't know what else to say.
We thought we'd do an interview format for the seminar, and then if you want to ask questions at any point, but particularly at the end, that will be great. Perhaps we can start, Diana, by just giving a rerun of what it was that James saw and heard that motivated him to go and protest in Burma, forget his mortgage and his...
He didn't have one, thank God. He didn't leave that behind him.
And his pension and all of the trappings of the world. What led him to go to Burma?
James had met refugees in New Zealand. And I'd always tried to bring up the children, if you hear something that is rather odd, outrageous, find out from all the sources you can. He thought what he was hearing from these refugees was a bit OTT. So he decided to go to Burma to find out. And he worked inside Burma in a school for the internally displaced Karen. And he found that everything he had been told was true, even worse than he had imagined. I asked him, with the atrocities that were committed against the ethnic minorities, how could young men, these lovely, smiling young men, the soldiers, how could they do it? How could they ram a broken bottle into a young girl? How could they gang rape? How could they torture, torment? And of course, the answer is rather simple. They're mostly conscripts. They are in terrible fear. And heroin is such an easy way of clouding their minds and giving them, taking away the reality of what they're doing. So if you're high on drugs and terrified, that seems to be the only answer. But he worked in that school teaching the children English, and they were so willing to learn. Old-fashioned desks. Then the news came that the Tatmadaw, the Burmese army, was on the march, and they had to be evacuated. And James was among the 4,000 terrified people who were driven as beaters drive grass to the border of Thailand, where only the women and children were accepted. The men were driven back. James was accepted over the border because of the colour of his skin. And when he came home to England and told us about it, he said, I can't leave it. I dream about it. I must do something. And that is when he started.
So he went back outside of Burma, and then he went back to Rangoon and made a peaceful protest. What happened after that?
He got 5 years in prison for doing what we do on Hyde Park Corner, you know, every Sunday. And he went to one of the most notorious prisons in the world, insane prison. Insane by name, by nature. Cruel. The conditions are unbelievable. I found that visit, my first visit to James, rather difficult. But he's very like his elder brother. They're both tall, both same bone structure. And when we walked in with my elder son, the guards did a double take. They thought somehow James had nipped out of the cell and was standing with me in jeans. But that visit was quite painful, but he was only in prison for 3 months. He was tortured, but his torture, although pretty terrible, was nothing like what is handed out to the native Burmese, and he recognizes that. And when my husband brought him home, he said, well, James, have you had enough? And he said, no, Dad, I've just begun. And so it went on from there, and he worked. We are not a family with a great deal of money. He worked in any job he could. He labored on the Olympic site in Australia. Any laboring job, nothing was too... he did it, and he earned his money. But this time he planned his visit to Burma. He got Jubilee campaign involved. Lord Alton, who would never, never, he was like a terrier with a rat, he would never let go all that time James was in prison. What we as a family could have done without Jubilee, we couldn't have managed. Because every time publicity, the press, we got good press on the whole, but when it all went out of the papers and it seemed to be that James was forgotten and the Foreign Office wasn't bothering, Jubilee was there behind us, always putting it forward. So James ended up with a 17-year jail sentence. He got 10 years for... 5 years for illegal entry, in spite of the fact he entered quite legally with a visa on his passport. 7 years for...
7 years for Printing and Publishing Act.
Against the Printers and Publishing Act, because the literature he brought with him were leaflets in Burmese saying, have talks with the NLD. So they hadn't been licensed, so that was an offence against the Printers and Publishers Act. 7 years for that. And then another five. They didn't tell him about the other five until 10 days after he was imprisoned. They said, oh, by the way, you're now 17 years, not 12.
I think the other 5 years was the sentence that was commuted the first time.
Yes.
So they thought they'd kick that on the end to make it a rounded 17 for good measure.
Yes. Even though he didn't break any of the... He signed a paper when he left Burma the first time to say he would never enter the country illegally. He made quite sure he entered legally. He went across... I think it's called the Friendship Bridge, and got a day pass. And it took the British Embassy 5 months to get hold of that passport, and the entry stamp was quite valid. But he ended up in the prison in Kentung, which is the middle of the capital of the Golden Triangle. It's the heroin capital of the world. And in that little town, they've got a prison, mostly army deserters. These are young conscripts who could not bear the brutality of their military life and have tried to escape it and have been given 20, 25, 30-year prison sentences. James tried to communicate as much as possible, but it's a bit difficult in solitary confinement. They wanted him not to communicate with anybody for obvious reasons. But he tried to build up a rapport with the prison guards. And one guard, James was saying to him, you know, 17 years is a bit long for what I did. And the guard turned to him and said, Maudsley, I am here for life. The guards are also, they have no hope. Their pay is something in the region of £1 a month. They hate it as much as we did, I suppose.
So you are faced with the unusual circumstance of your boy in jail for the second time or even the third time. What is going through your minds, and what did you do at that stage?
Well, James asked us to campaign for the broader issue. He said, campaign for Burma, Mum, not for my release in particular. And we felt we had to keep faith. And so that is what we did. And the Burma situation, since James's imprisonment, there has been 3 debates in the House of Commons, and 4, I think, in the House of Lords, initiated by Lord Alton. And James has spoken in the European Parliament since his release, because there's a very strong group who wish to help Dorsu and to get rid of this military junta. But I don't know. I only know that there's a lot of money being made in Burma, certainly from the oil companies. And I can't understand why we are treating with a regime which is so obviously illegal. They took power by force, and they hold it by force and terror, while the democratically elected leader remains under house arrest.
So I remember that by the time we came to Greenbelt last year, the campaign was up and running. We were all dealing with a lot of media exposure. I remember a year ago, Diana was reminding me that we had an interview with Radio 5 Live and Edwina Curry, and, you know, being a media person, I said, Diana, just don't mention eggs, you know, just try to steer clear. And halfway through the interview, we're listening to it on the radio, Edwina Curry asked something like, you know, did you ever expect this to happen? And Diana replies, well, I've known him since the egg and I never expected it. And we were there shaking our heads, but...
It was an accident, I assure you. If they hadn't been impressing on me for hours before the interview not to mention eggs, I wouldn't have.
All my carefully planned consultancy down the drain, but...
The campaign went on. Jubilee have been marvellous. Also Baroness Cox in Christian Solidarity Worldwide. So many people from that organisation wrote to James, the letters that they just flooded in, over to Burma and to me. Some were canny and wrote via the diplomatic bag and got the Foreign Office a bit crossed, but anyway, many of them got through. Some wrote directly to Burma, and the extraordinary thing is the number of letters that actually James did receive. If they wanted to punish him, of course, they withheld his books, withheld his letters. And one terrible time they contaminated his food with salt and disinfectant. I'd like to impress upon you that we always knew where James was. Every month the consul saw him. Whereas the Burmese prisoners, they're just, we don't know. There's a young man called Min Ko Nai. He was given 25 years solitary 11 years ago. And he's still alive, but no one knows where he is. So the time went on, and I was due for another visit to James. But because the vice consul had been so courageous and refused to hand over a paper that James had signed to the authorities, they built a big glass box. So they said all his visitors then, he had to go into the glass box, that his visitors would no longer be able to... Well, I've kissed him on each visit. And so I got up to the jail... And I was waiting. I'd been to the market and I bought fruit and supplies. And then the prison governor came in and, through his interpreter, said, James has said he does not wish to see anybody while he is in the glass box. It is inhumane. But because he is your mother, you are his mother, he will leave the decision to you. And I sat and thought, what message is James trying to give me? And I thought perhaps he's saying to me that they have his body, but his mind is still free. That all decisions have been removed from him, but he can actually make this decision. So I said, all right, then I won't see him. And the governor betrayed his knowledge of English, because he literally yelped. They couldn't believe it, that I would go away without seeing my son. But I did. And I flew back to Rangoon, and I was getting ready to come home again, feeling a bit sad, but always knowing the consul would see him next month. And then I had news. I was sitting in the British club in Rangoon, and the deputy head of mission came over with a very large whiskey in his hand and said, just come and sit over here. I think you might need this. And he told me about James's beatings, that he'd been beaten over 3 days and had... I think a fractured rib and very broken nose. And I thought, well, glass box or no glass box, I will go up and see him. So I flew up and saw him. They let me see him. But that beating, although it was distressing at the time, was just, I think, the last straw, because it got a lot of publicity. Jubilee and Christian Solidarity Worldwide had not stopped the campaign. The United Nations had already ruled that the junta had broken 10 points of international law by imprisoning James. And then Premier Oil got a little bit excited and thought this wasn't good for their image. And at 11 o'clock one night, I was just going to bed, preparing to fly out the next day, when the vice consul came running upstairs, banged on the door, and I opened it, and I said, oh God, James is dead. That was my first... I didn't know why she'd be coming to see me at 11 o'clock. And she just said, Diana, they're letting him go. I can't tell you the joy. It was fantastic. And they all knew back here in England. I was the last to know. So was the mission in Rangoon. The Foreign Office had already known. And we waited till he was still in the prison. They flew him down 4 days later. He chained him in the plane and he went to the lavatory, and the military intelligence man stood outside the lavatory. Now, I really ask you, what was he going to do, you know, jump off the plane, jump out the window. And the British ambassador, who is a man of faith himself, he wanted us to stay in the residency, which I'd love to have done, but the junta wouldn't let James leave the airport. We went straight onto a flight to Bangkok, and I've never seen such media. I don't know how these pop stars managed to retain their sanity, but he was out. I ask myself sometimes, what good has it done? How can we quantify what results? And we don't really know. We do know that James has raised awareness of Burma. There's a lot more people know about the terrible injustices in Burma. When I was coming through Bangkok after my first visit, there were two Burmese refugees in the duty-free, and I bought the regulation bottle of scotch from my friends. One of the girls put an extra bottle of scotch and a box of chocolates, and threw her arms around me and kissed me when she saw my passport. So we feel that if that was just one isolated incident, then there must be a lot of people in Burma who are hoping that things will change and that James has brought their plight into the open.
I remember someone coming to me and asking, what's the point of what James has done? What's he really achieved? Has their life been made any easier by what James has done? And I remember James telling a story to me when he returned, and he said that on his 20 minutes of exercise a day that he got to walk around the courtyard, he was just minding his own business when over the fence he saw a hand coming over towards him, and he wondered what it was. And he reached up, and the hand just grabbed his hand, and they just met. And he realized it was another prisoner on the other side, just showing his solidarity, because he realized that in a country so isolated, that what it meant to him to have somebody from the West who has nothing to do with Burma, to come and be able to stand with them, to be able to come into their world like Christ came into our world, to be able to suffer with them, meant so much to them, meant so much to him. And you can't quantify the value of that sort of action to that particular individual. One of the questions, though, that James was also asked, like Bob Geldof after Live Aid, is that it? What now? Tell us, Dinah, what James is hoping to do with his life now.
Well, he's been speaking to the groups up and down the country, people who have small amnesty groups. What is freedom groups in all the churches that have written to him and supported him. He's been going along to meet these people and to talk. He's spoken to the amnesty group in Jersey and found that one of the women there was the mother of one of the monks at Ampleforth, where I went on retreat. I felt I couldn't handle James's release. But he's also spoken to the European Parliament. He's spoken to the Human Rights Caucus in the United States, to the House of Congress and to the House of Representatives, and he's going to New Orleans to speak. So the issues at least are being raised. It's pressure, I suppose, constant pressure to be placed on governments to stop investing in Burma. America has banned all new investment in Burma, but there is still their big oil company there, Unocal. I don't know. You know, sometimes I'm full of hope, and other times I think I simply don't know.
You were talking earlier about the politics of the situation. In 62, the military first overtook Burma, and then in 1990, they allowed, after the student uprisings in 88, they allowed elections to be held when Daw Aung San Suu Kyi won those elections. What do you see, Dinah, as the... You've spent time in the refugee camps.
Oh, yes.
What do you see as the political solution to the problem?
Oh, the solution to the problem is to let the elected leader rule. But how are we in the West to do that? I don't know. James says we should be attacking the junta at all times and give them no support whatever, because they live on the petrodollars. But if Daw Soo was ruling Burma, the two things would be resolved, the democracy movement and the ongoing genocide against the ethnic minorities, because she has promised to honour a promise given to the Karen by our government after the war, that they would have not independence but a degree of autonomy. That promise was not honoured. I don't know why. I think England certainly was war weary, but our promise to the Karen was not honoured, and the result is this genocide. Now Dorsu has promised that she will honour that promise to give autonomy to the, a degree of autonomy to the ethnic minorities. But how to get her into power is another thing, because she was elected. When you think 82% of an 85% turnout is pretty good.
The other point, the latest news that we have is one of the key issues in Burma is what to do with the number of refugees that are amassing on the borders of the countries surrounding Burma. About 120,000 Karen refugees in Thailand alone. That's not including the Shan, the Kareni, the Mon, the Rakhine, the Rohingya. There are a vast number, and you've spent time in the refugee camps.
Well, I visited a refugee camp, and I was horrified to see that it was down on a Thai poster, along with white water rafting as the tourist attraction. But I was out there to give my services as a nursing sister in a clinic on the border, Dr. Cynthia's clinic. And I saw what James was trying to do, and I thought to myself, you know, I wish you hadn't done it, darling, but I see why you've done it. Everybody there in that clinic, there were mine injuries, legs blown off by mines, the junta lay mines all around the borders. But no matter what was wrong with the patients, it was always complicated by malaria. The malaria is shocking. And it is ironic that the present Burmese ambassador to this country is a doctor, doctor of medicine, and he spends a great deal of time in Edinburgh on malaria research. I don't think the Karen will ever get the benefit. But also, we are walking around, most of us in this tent, with a hemoglobin level of between 12, 13. We'd be pretty anemic, considered, if it was 10. These people's hemoglobin was 3 and 4. I don't know how they stood on their feet. There were young girls there who by the soldiers, and they were giving birth. But everybody had a drip with the anti-malaria drugs. And the National Health Service, well, it takes a lot of flack. But if you knew how precious the drugs were, how nothing was wasted, I see in my course of my work a lot of waste. And I see there how carefully husbanded everything is. But I did go and I visited a refugee camp, and I was impressed by the humour, the good spirits, which must be, in a way, forced, because they have no hope. No immediate hope, but also with the cleanliness of the camp. But it isn't very good to have your meals delivered to you twice a day, and there is some law that the Thais have reinvoked that prevents these people growing their own little vegetable patches. But the tragedy is these are real refugees from terror. Some of them are driven across the border by the army. The Thai army's on the other side to drive them back, and they are literally on the Moy River, caught between two armies. The refugee problem is a terrible one.
The most current news that we have from the Thai-Burma border is that the Thai authorities are trying to forcibly repatriate around 5,000 Karen starting immediately. And this despite the United Nations High Commission on Refugees putting the case that they should stay in Thailand until such a time where it's safe for them to return. So the issue is very live, it's very present as we speak. And since 1992, around 30,000 Karen have been killed as a direct or indirect result of the military on their lives, constantly attacking them and the places that they live.
There is another political point here too, that Thailand is a member of ASEAN, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. And no one is denying that Thailand has a terrible problem with the refugees along their border. But Thailand voted to admit Burma, as did Malaysia and Singapore, all of whom invest in Burma. China, of course, is Burma's big brother. But I saw a young Burmese man wearing a T-shirt that said, Burma, ASEAN's shame. Burma should not be admitted to ASEAN. It's like, not NATO, but the European Common Market. It's the Asian equivalent. Burma should not have been admitted to this with its human rights record. But it was, and it was admitted willingly by those nations who wished to benefit from its natural wealth.
I just wanted to, we leave some time for questions. I wanted to perhaps ask you, Dinah, in relation to James's faith while he was in prison and how that was affected. And then just read to you one scripture that James sent back while he was in jail, and then open it out for questions. But
one of James's letters was held back for a long time because the authorities, the military intelligence, thought these biblical quotations were some form of code, some secret code. And they're quite paranoid. But yes, James was, his faith was strong, but he was sustained by his faith. It's in prison. It helped him bear the terrible isolation because he was losing his rag towards the end with solitary confinement. And that was his protest, not against his prison sentence, but that solitary confinement is inhumane. And although James's solitary was nothing like the Burmese, because he did get a visitor once a month, it is a terrible thing to be thrown in on your own resources. And one day they had to carry him back from his exercise period, carry him back into his cell, because he said, I'm not going back. Every month he said to me that he knew he had to brace himself for a request from the consul to sign something. And every month he had to get over that visit without signing anything, because he knew then that if he did, it would be a total and utter failure. And he did. He prayed enormously for the strength not to give in each month to that. So he was certainly sustained by his very strong faith. But he said in his journal that he's worked and studied with people, Muslims and Buddhists, who all call God by different names, but who've all got the same purpose, to seek the truth.
I just wanted to read from Romans 12, starting at verse 9. Love must be sincere. Hate what is evil. Cling to what is good. Be devoted to one another in brotherly love. Honor one another above yourself. Never be lacking in zeal, but keep your spiritual fervor, serving the Lord. Be joyful in hope, patient in affliction, faithful in prayer. Share with God's people who are in need. Practice hospitality. Bless those who persecute you. Bless and do not curse. Rejoice with those who rejoice. Mourn with those who mourn. Live in harmony with one another. Do not be proud, but be willing to associate with people of low position. Do not be conceited. Do not repay evil for evil. Be careful to do what is right in the eyes of everybody. Do not take revenge, my friends, but leave room for God's wrath. For it is written, it is mine to avenge. I will repay, says the Lord. On the contrary, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him something to drink. In doing this, you will be heap burning coals on his head. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. And I don't think that there's any more suitable explanation or insight into what James was doing than is contained in those passages from Romans 9. Are there any further questions? We've got about 15 minutes. Are there any further questions? I'll come and find you. I'll start here and then come to you.
Diana, you've made it very clear that we really ought to write and support people who are in the same position that your son's been in. And I apologise for not doing it.
Oh, please do.
I think I probably speak for a lot of people who are here. But what I would like to know is, you've already mentioned about the companies, the oil companies and other companies, that we really ought to be boycotting. Do you have a list?
The trouble with oil is that we never quite know where it's coming from. I always pass my local Total garage and go to a Jet garage, but I don't really know where Jet comes from. Write to Premier Oil and Total. I don't think you will get anywhere in... They will write back and they will say to you how much they're doing for human rights. They deny that they have cleared the land of the ethnic minorities for their pipeline. They deny that people have been recruited as forced porters. They carry the all the army's guns, etc., on their back. Age or sex, no difference, whatever. Whole villages have been cleared. People are used as human minesweepers and as porters. But the oil companies, I have a letter here, too long to read out, from the managing director of Total in Paris. He denies everything. He says they're doing wonderful work for Save the Children and they're doing a good job in Burma. Well, I haven't seen at first hand the results of their pipeline, but James has. He has seen the devastation that has been caused. He said he stood on a hill in Karenni territory and he wept. James is not that easily moved to tears. But he wept. And it's got to him so, so deeply in his heart that he will never leave a situation in Burma alone. As far as writing, write to the junta, write to the Burmese ambassador. Letters do work. Poor Robin Cook, James's birthday is St. Valentine's Day. Jubilee organised Valentine cards with James's picture behind bars. Robin Cook had millions. He had more Valentine cards than anyone in the kingdom. The Foreign Office begged us to stop. They said, we've got the message. Please direct the cards now to the Burmese, which we did.
So I'll just come to this man at the end.
But letters do work.
Diana, you've mentioned the oil companies. Who else has economic interests in Burma and the power and influence on whom we can put pressure? And what other ways are there that we can put pressure? Is it worth sort of buying a token shareholding so we can turn up to the AGM? Is it worth... Are our governments still giving export credit guarantees for military or non-military exports to Burma? Do our banks support Burma? Do they bankroll Burma?
I think not. To be fair to the West, we have pulled out of Burma. Pepsi-Cola pulled out. Who make the jeans? Is it Levi's? They pulled out. A lot of the bankrolling for Burma does in fact come from ASEAN countries and from China. And again, to be fair to the West, I don't think we sell arms to Burma. They come from China. As far as what can we do, just what the lady said here, letters do work. But perhaps we should be sending those letters not only to our own governments, but to the countries of ASEAN. Extraordinarily enough, there was a letter from the Holy See, from the Pope, to the Chinese president on James's behalf. That was another thing that broke the camel's back, because the Holy See recognises very much the support that China gives Burma. So I can only say we should perhaps direct many of our letters to the governments, to the ambassadors of the ASEAN countries in London. But in Britain, our only real investment is Premier Oil, although the British Council are there, and they teach English, but most of their pupils are military intelligence, and I rather resent that.
One of the problems with Burma is that because of its isolation, there are very few economic handles or levers with which to put pressure on the military junta. And when we met with some of the minister who's responsible for consular affairs, she was making this point as well. But we were encouraging her to introduce tougher sanctions on Burma, and that's a particularly contentious issue. But we felt that was an important suggestion to make, not least because Aung San Suu Kyi herself had said that this is an important stand to make, and that differentiated it from sanctions, say, brought on Iraq, where it's actually curtailing the people's conditions. And tougher sanctions on Burma is one thing that we can put pressure on our government to do. because currently the only sanctions that are really in place are those that restrict the financial assets, movement of the military junta, but you're free to trade. And tourism is one key link that continues to support or give revenue to the military power.
Yes, every tourist has to pay $200 American when they arrive because the junta is desperate for foreign currency. I wouldn't do it, but as I was the mother of the old lag, I got away with it. But yes, the AGM, Jubilee did that and embarrassed, I think, a few of the shareholders.
There are a number of existing pro-democracy movements in Britain, like the Burma campaign. Is Jubilee working as a Christian initiative in isolation from those or alongside?
Question was about relationships with other NGOs working on the Burma democracy issue. Our particular focus, yet we know the Burma campaign, the Burma coalitions and John Jackson and the like, and working well with them. Our focus is on the genocide happening against the ethnic minorities, not so much to do with the democracy issue. So our focus is in what is actually happening in the killing, raping, torturing, internally displacing of the ethnic minorities in Burma. That's the human rights issues. That's the angle that we're taking. And very, very few, in fact, no other NGO that we know, are actually naming what's happening as genocide, despite it fitting three of the four international conditions necessary for the definition of genocide. And the government is reluctant to use the definition genocide because of the implications it would mean for them to take action in Burma. So our focus in Jubilee is on the ethnic minorities and on what they're experiencing. And in that sense, it does complement the existing work going on surrounding the democracy issue and the political struggle. Sorry, I'll just come to...
Diana, you mentioned that the petrodollars and heroin are key in keeping the junta financed. It's just starting to be a debate over here about the influence of illegal drugs and Class A drugs, etc., on the streets of Britain and America. Could you comment, though, on the effect of being a supplier country, the actual proliferation of heroin throughout the communities in Burma has on the people?
For me, for all tourists... The junta like to keep you away from the first-hand... The whole places are out of bounds. You'll have military checkpoints that you can't get past when they know there's a village, perhaps, which is ridden with AIDS and with drug dependence. But James has seen it because James has been moving around a little bit quietly. He even joked with the MI about the poppies, but they're big poppy fields. Most of Burma's heroin ends up in the United States. I think ours comes from Afghanistan. So I think that may account for America is... The United States government is rather stronger than our government on Burma because of this. As far as the local population is concerned, again, James saw it in the prison. He said most of the guards... are on heroin. He said he did his exercise period, came back to get something into his cell and found two of them sharing a needle and injecting, and he just said, "I'm sorry," and walked away. And I think there are whole villages that are smitten with AIDS. There is a strain now called the Burma strain. They can identify it because the outlets, one way towards Thailand and one way to China, it's a terrible influence, the amount of heroin produced there. And of course, it's a great cash crop. I'm sorry?
The Western demand creates the supply.
Oh, yes, of course, the Western demand does, yes. But also the effect on the people in the mountain villages is quite terrible. Yes, yes. But heroin is such a good drug. I mean, I'm a nurse by profession, and it is a tremendous painkiller. But used as it is used, it's the other sort of killer, yes. But the war tribe, WA, they control the heroin, the poppy field, and they're well in with the junta. And it makes me angry to see the generals with their little fat stomachs attending anti-drug meetings, etc., in New York, in the UN, etc., and saying that they're doing their best to stamp out the trade. They are propped up by the trade.
I want to thank you for what you've done. I'm over here. I want to thank you for what you've done. This was James's fight, and he brought it to the world attention, but you brought it to our hearts this time last year, and for what you've done, because I remember you said that you didn't want to be doing all this, that you were a quiet person who wanted to lead a family life. I want to thank you that you made us pray for James and for Burma, and could you tell us how to pray now for the future for this country?
Oh, I couldn't be impertinent enough to tell you how to pray, because prayers are so personal. But I do thank you for what you've said. And I did say to someone, when I get that bloody boy out of there, I shall do something. And in fact, I don't know if any of you saw the Everyman programme, but I had no idea that we were being filmed. And I told, it didn't take me long to get back into telling off the children. I told him off quite firmly that he looked like a dropout and that he should change his clothes, and it was televised and went all around. And someone wrote in and said that was the best part of the programme, to see this political activist being told off by his mum. But I do thank you. I thank you all. I was so afraid this morning no one would come. My stomach was knotted, and I thought, I want to be on that train home again, and it's so lovely to see you all and to be so kindly received.
Time for a couple more questions. Start down here at the front.
This isn't actually a question. This is a comment on something that I believe is still going on. The Lonely Planet, who write travel books, and most people have probably bought a Lonely Planet book sometime in their lives, they're actually still producing one on Burma.
They are.
And they still condone travelling on a tourism basis to Burma.
Yes.
And I know plenty of complaints have been made about this, but they won't withdraw their book.
No, they won't. And Dorsu herself has asked for that book to be withdrawn. She has indeed. Yes. And the thing is, it is really sad, because Burma is such a beautiful country. And there was a letter in the Daily Mail. This man said that he'd been to Burma, he'd been to Mandalay, and he called James a foolhardy jaunt. Well, I mean, we're all entitled. We can have an opinion at the moment. And he said, the country's been called Myanmar for more than 11 years, but for some perverse reason, the world persists in calling it Burma. The generals named it Myanmar. That's the perverse reason that most of us continue. During our stay on a volunteer assignment, we found the people to be contented Buddhists, gentle, polite, and helpful. The country seems to be crime-free, its people are not hungry, and the country does not owe money. How many can make that claim? I read that letter and I was astonished how that man has spent time in Mandalay, which admittedly the generals keep pretty clean because it's a place where tourists go, but not to see the reality about him, not to understand that 40% of the gross national product is spent on guns from China, that their national debt is... The country is hovering on bankruptcy. The inflation rate, I don't know the exact figures, but the chat, which is their currency, is worth nothing. That's why they are so desperate for foreign currency. I found that man's letter remarkable.
But our position in terms of tourism is qualified slightly, in as much as if you're going to go to Burma, be an intelligent tourist. Go there, get off the beaten track. Don't stay in the state-built hotels that are built on the back of slave labour. My own twin brother went to the Thai-Burma border just recently and managed to slip into Burma and talk to people and learn, and he didn't contribute to anything other than the local economy. So it's not just about never going near the country and never knowing anything about it, but it is about being intelligent with the resources that we've got and being selective with what we see and who we help. There's another question over here that we've got time for, maybe one more after this.
My father grew up in Burma a long time ago, and he's always explaining what a beautiful place it was and what beautiful people they are. But could you talk about the legal trade in animal products that is going on there, as well as heroin?
I don't think I know of... Is it so?
Well, that was one of the things that was brought up in the John Pilger programme recently.
I have to confess that I haven't seen it.
Ah.
When was that broadcast?
Fairly recently.
I was out of the country for 2 months. I went out to see James. I expected to be gone for a week, and I was there 2 months. I wonder, was it then?
Probably. I can't remember myself.
What sort of animal products?
Tiger products, particularly.
Tiger? Mm. Oh, I wouldn't be at all surprised. There's a terrible trade in the teak, too, the ravaging of the teak forests. When Britain was there, the teak forests were very well managed.
That was going to be my next question. I'm a woodworker, so I want to know, you know, what I can do about, you know, stopping the country being plundered.
Well, right. But I flew flying over the delta, the mouths of the Irrawaddy. You can see the devastation that has been done to the teak forest. They're not interested in proper forestry, proper husbandry. It is to get the money, to have cash in hand, to buy their guns, to oppress the people. But when, before the war, the Forestry Commission tended the teak forests very, very well. But I wouldn't be at all surprised about the tigers. Everything is ravaged in that beautiful, beautiful land. And many people remember the British with affection.
I think it's true that about 80% of the teak forests in that country have now been dissipated. So in terms of what your contribution is there, then I think that if there's any way of influencing how they're treating the natural resources that they have there, then I would encourage you to do that. We'll just we're just over time. We've just got one quick question here.
The way to solve this seems to be, or to support, you've been emphasising, is to write. And I was thinking of the Christian Aid Jubilee 2000 letters to our own MPs.
Oh, yes.
And I think that if everybody wrote to their own MP, that would spread the word. There would be a greater lobbying of our government.
You are
absolutely right. And that is where it feels to me,
yes,
this emphasis needs to go, because our government is responsible and needs to do something.
You're very right, and that would be great. If you were all to write to your MP now, I can just imagine them all saying, oh my God, it's that Maudsley again. Thought he'd gone quiet. Oh dear. And I thank you all most sincerely for coming and receiving us so kindly. Thank you.